Romans 13. Romans 13. All of what we've been discussing for the last several weeks is predicated, all of Paul's theology about how you deal with the church and how you deal with society at large, how you deal with unbelievers, is all predicated on one large notion, which is that God is in control. And that's a subject of some debate among different theologians and different churches and different denominations who have different theologies. They debate the degree to which God is in control. Everybody who writes about God or thinks about God or speaks about God is willing to allow that he's in control of some things. If they read the Bible, they see that God declares himself to be in control of things. And then the debate usually has to do with how much control does God have? How much control is God in? Some churches will say God is in control where the big events are concerned. And I'm not sure how they differentiate the big from the little events or how big an event has to be for God to actually kick in. But they will say that God is in charge of the big important events, that if it's really critical to God, he'll play in, but then there's smaller events that God isn't in control of. The Bible declares, and certainly sovereign grace theology declares, that God is in complete control, that God is in ultimate control, that God is in universal control. There are three major characteristics of God described in the Bible, that he is omnipotent, that he is omniscient, that he is omnipresent. So if you walk through those three for a second, omnipotent, omnipotent, potency has to do with power or might. God declares himself all the time. First time he showed up to Abraham, he said, I am God Almighty. Showed up to Moses and said, I'm God Almighty. Every time he showed up and introduced himself, he made the point, I am God who has all the power. And when God says all the power, despite what theologians may want to debate, I'm willing to believe that what he meant was, I have all the power. Which means if there is some power somewhere, anywhere in the universe, independent of God, God is not, in fact, all-powerful, he's just mostly powerful. But there is some power out there independent of God, and he can no longer honestly call himself all-powerful because there's something out there that has its own power. Now, if he is, in fact, all-powerful, the implication of that is there is nothing that happens in his universe that he does not, in fact, empower. If anything can power itself, or empower itself, then God is not all-powerful. There's some power independent of him. The power it took for you to wake up and know your name is God's power. He empowered that, or you are independent of God and have some power within yourself that he didn't give you. Life itself exists because God deigned that life itself would exist. Big Bang theories aside, I got a really interesting letter from a girl who I chat back and forth with a lot, who you all haven't met. Her father is an astronomer and physicist, and the thing that she was afraid would keep him from ever coming to recognize God for who he is was the fact that he was a scientist at heart. And as he went and explored and continues to explore the universe, he keeps coming back and saying the Big Bang is impossible, because what you find out there are star clusters, planet clusters, random universes, things that make no sense if the Big Bang theory is true. If the Big Bang is true and you extrapolate it back to whatever the single mass or gas or whatever it was that exploded, then there would be evidence universally of that Big Bang because everything came from it. So if you find anything out there that seems random or can't be traced to the Big Bang, or if you find anything, any star clusters in and of themselves moving in a way opposite of the way everything else is moving, then you have these conundrums out in space that say, well, no, this actually says creator. This doesn't say Big Bang. And he himself now has admitted to her that there must be a creator out there because there's no other way to explain the way the universe functions and operates. And she said, wouldn't you know, the one thing I thought would keep him from God is the one thing that's driving him to God. That he's such a scientist that he needed proof, and now he's finding the proof in the universe that there must be a God out there. So he is all-powerful. Life exists because he empowered life to exist. If the Big Bang is not true and creationism is true, then God made the first people because he wanted to make the first people, and it says that he blew into Adam's nostrils, made him a living soul, and life existed on planet Earth because God empowered life to exist on planet Earth. Anything that happens in God's universe must be empowered by God, or else there is some power external to God, and he doesn't allow for that. So omnipotent. omnipresent. What does that mean? Yeah, everywhere, but not just everywhere. Everywhere
at the same
time. That's the important point. Not just everywhere running real fast, but everywhere at the same time. One of my problems as a kid, and when I would pray as a child, was that I could think clearly enough to think, how could God, who must have a pretty thick schedule, take the time out to listen to me? Because what if there's another million people praying right now? What if we're all praying at the same time? How can he possibly be paying attention to me? How can he know what I'm saying? Until I began to understand omnipresence. This was a great relief to me, because if he is in fact capable of being everywhere at once, then he can be here with me and still be with the starving children who are crying out for help in Indochina somewhere, and still be in Africa helping them, and can still be, you know, in Europe. So, and he can be right here with me. That's why I say sometimes, and you guys can tell it, sometimes it's Jim talking, and then sometimes the room just kind of calms down, and everybody's in the same frame of mind, and suddenly the word does its job and starts speaking to you, and time kind of stands still for a moment. And I've told Mike a zillion times, it's because the king was present. When the king shows up, he does his work. He said, I will be there. If the words being preached were gathered in his name, he guaranteed that he'd show up. And when he does, he operates. He does his work. He moves in hearts. He changes minds. He teaches people. I might be over here rattling off, but if he doesn't show up, nothing happens here. So omnipresence and omnipower combined means that God is everywhere in order to empower everything. Got those two? Then omniscient means what? All-knowing. Knows everything. Doesn't just know everything that was and is, but knows everything that's going to happen, which is why we could have prophecy in the Bible. The only reason prophecy works is because the future is definite. Otherwise, prophecy doesn't work. If prophecy is just a guess, but the future is arbitrary, then prophecy wouldn't work. Unless I know for sure what's going to happen in an hour, I can't tell you what's going to happen in an hour. But if the future is definite, and God tells me what's going to happen in an hour, and he's the one who's going to empower what happens in an hour, and he's the one who knows what's happening in an hour, and then he tells me what's happening in an hour, and I tell you, it will definitely happen because the future is in fact definite. Because the one who empowers the future is determining the future. The reason he could say 2,000 years before the fact that the Christ was coming was because he knew what day he was coming, what day he'd be born, how long he'd live, and the very day he would die. He knew all that. The reason that he could say, when Jesus' disciples came to him and said, "Will you return the kingdom to Israel at this time?" He said, "It's not for you to know the days, the hours, the times that the Father has placed in his own hands." In other words, the Father knows. The Father has it. The Father has determined it. The big calendar is ticking. You don't know, but he knows, and that's good enough for God. God never said that you had to know everything that was going to happen. What he said was, I know what's going to happen. Trust me. Have faith in me. Everything God does, he does for his glory and your good. If you're his own, he is working on your behalf and for your benefit and for his greatest glory. That's because it's definite. It's gonna happen. Concepts like election, which people struggle with so much, predestination, are all predicated on the notion that God is all-powerful, empowering everything, that he is everywhere at once, and that he does know everything. Not only does he know everything that is going to happen, but he also knows all of the options. He knows if this, then here. If that, then that. He understands the chain of events that lead up to absolutely everything. He understands what you're going to do because he knows you better than you know yourself. He knows your heart, he knows your mind, and he knows the limitations he's placed on you. There are limitations to what you are. There are limits to your will. You cannot will yourself to be something you are not. God determined what you are. That's why Jeremiah would say, can a leopard change his spots? Can an Ethiopian change his skin? No, no. And then he said, well, then so will you that are evil do something good. Oh, well, I like the first half of the question. First half was easy. No, leopards don't change their spots because they're leopards. And leopards look like that. Ethiopians, black men, they can't change their skin because that's the way they were born, because that's what they are, because God determined they would be that. Well, then you are what you are. You can't change what you are, and you will naturally follow the inclinations of what you are. And God determined what you are, which means that God is the only one who can determine for you not to be that anymore. So what if you are what Jesus called a rotten tree that produces rotten fruit? The only hope you have of ever producing good fruit is to make the tree good. That's what Jesus said. He said, first make the tree good, and then it'll produce good fruit. Good trees cannot produce rotten fruit. Rotten trees cannot produce good fruit. So you can't go to rotten trees and say, make good fruit. You can yell at a rotten tree from the outside all day long and not change the tree and not change the fruit. Try it. Find an old, dying, rotten fruit tree and yell at it and beat it and throw a Bible at it and tell it to get good. It can't. It's a rotten tree. It has to be a good tree to produce good fruit. And only the one who is omniscient, who is omnipotent, and who has the power can make rotten people good. The only reason you have any ability to produce the good fruit we've been talking about in Romans here, the only reason that you might be able to act the way Paul is saying you should act and respond the way he's saying you can respond is because God has done something to you internally, changed you internally. The one who has the ability to change you has changed you so that you would speak well of your enemies. Anybody in here lately spoke well of an enemy? That's hard. He used the word eulogize. Eulogize. You usually keep a eulogy for a funeral. The last opportunity to say something good about the person who just died. It's the exact word he uses. He said, eulogize them that curse you. And then he repeats it. Bless, I say, and curse not. Overcome evil with good. You would never do that unless you had been changed from the inside and understood that there was some higher authority, some higher power, some higher law, some higher standard that you were approaching. And that you could understand, okay, that guy's going to get his because, after all, God's in control. So now, knowing all these things, God is omniscient, God is omnipotent, God is omnipresent. How much control is God in? Name something God's not in control of. You can't. Now, you say that, but do you believe it? How much do you believe it? The lot is cast into the lap. The present-day version of a lot is dice. You take two dice and you throw them down in your lap, and it comes up a number. You can go to Las Vegas and do that because they believe it's based on random principles, that if you just stand there and throw dice, that every number that comes up is completely random. The lot is cast into the lap, and the whole disposing thereof is of the Lord. If you go to Las Vegas and throw the dice and lose, God made you lose. Do you believe that? Yeah, it's true. If you go to Las Vegas and throw the dice and win, God made you win for his own purposes, for his own reasons, because he's in that much control. Now, we like the, oh, God's really in control where salvation is concerned. But then if you break it down to those kind of levels, God's in that kind of control, then it gets stickier when you say things like, well, you know, I'm sick. Okay, God's in control. God made you sick. That's a hard one. Or at very least, God allowed that you are sick. God's in control here. The upside is, I'm sick. I'm sure happy God's in control. So you're broke. What are you going to do? Well, God's in control. You know? So suddenly you have great wealth. Wealth destroys people spiritually much quicker than poverty does. Poverty, you'll cry out to God and have a regular daily experience with God asking for help. Jesus said it's the man who has plenty in his barns and is full up that'll say, well, eat, drink, be merry. Take rest, my soul. I am wealthy and in need of nothing. And the rest of that parable is that God shows up and says, you fool. Tonight your soul will be required of you. And what will a man give in exchange for his soul? So wealth destroys people quicker than poverty does. Either way, God's in control. Getting this? Now, if God is in control of the way the world is going, what do you do about the fact that Clinton is in the White House? Paul's answer is, God is in control. I have a friend who I work with who's a very, very liberal woman. She's a liberal woman. And I have watched over the last several years as her political leanings have become more and more conservative because they've had to be. Because, as she says, the world is going to hell, and anybody who can't see that is stupid. If you can't admit that we are, that the whole society is being degraded systematically, then your eyes are closed. How can you miss the fact that we're just coming apart? Okay, the world seems to be coming apart. Is God in control? Yeah. Didn't he say it was going to be like that before he came back? Yeah. Is it happening? Yeah. God's still in control. I say, if you don't believe in God, if you don't have any concept of God, if you don't have any faith in God, if you're not convinced that God is in control, what good is sticking around in this world? Because this world is getting haywire. This world is getting crazier by the minute. So what's the value of working yourself to death every day to make money, to get more stuff, to get sick and die? What's the point? There is no point. Life becomes absolutely pointless if you don't recognize that there is God in control. Then, with that worldview, things start to make sense again. You start saying, oh, right. The Holy One said that the world would run more and more decadent so that when he came back in judgment, the whole world would stand guilty. Got it. There's a point to all this. But before he comes back in that judgment, he takes those that are his church, out of the world, and then comes back to judge the world. The big plan is at work. So it becomes more and more obvious, and the more decadent the world becomes, the more weird we become. Christians are standing out like sore thumbs now, which is why Christians, regardless of what you think of their particular theology, are becoming more and more castigated in the marketplace of ideas. You can say anything evil about Christians you want on TV or in the news or in the press, or say something bad about any other group, and they'll go haywire on you. I was watching news the other night, and they were systematically saying fundamentalist Christian, using that word fundamentalist, because they know that gets people upset. Fundamentalist, ooh. Fundamentalist Christian, and they were equating it with bigotry. Constantly. Over and over again, they kept doing it. So that anytime you hear the word Christian, the first thing you're going to think, if you're the world, is bigot. And at the same time, they're talking about hate crime. Now, who are the leading, then, candidates to commit hate crimes? Well, the bigots. Who are the bigots? The Christians. And yes, the church is shooting itself in the foot all the time, because there is a lot of ignorant Christianity out there shooting abortion doctors and doing things like that. What?
Like blowing up buildings.
Or blowing up buildings or whatever else, right.
Because I think it's biblical for them to do that.
Right.
It's not.
Right. And so it gives the world all the more ammunition to be able to say Christians are bigoted. But Christianity, genuine Christianity, true Christianity, is going to become a more and more difficult commodity to find on planet Earth the closer we get to Christ's return. And it will have to, naturally, exactly what's happening right now, it's going to have to become more and more a social stigma to be Christian as Christians and churches continue to make it easy on the world to denounce them. You know, the art of language, that is what politics are about these days, the way to twist words and spin doctor things. The spin now is very, very anti-Christian, and it's going to keep going that way. Or they re-spin Christianity, because they spin everything, to say that Christianity is something that it's not. They're redefining Christianity by more popularized history revisionist type of doctrine. In other words, well, if you were really a Christian, you would just love everybody and you wouldn't, you know, dislike everybody. If you were really a Christian, you would understand that the best thing for us to do is take all your money and give it to the poor through the taxes. If you were really a Christian, you would. So they're redefining what Christianity is. So if you don't fit that mold, you're not a real Christian, you're a bigot. Anyway, God's in control. There's my point. Yeah, the world's going to hell in a handbasket. Yeah, the elevator down seems to be really moving fast these days. Yeah, right, but God is in control. So then, should you support the government you don't agree with? Paul's answer is yeah, because God is in control. Paul's answer is, yeah, you know, vote if you have the right to vote, but don't forget when he was writing this stuff, there was a Caesar and nobody voted for Caesar. There was an evil government in place when he wrote this stuff. Christians were being burned and fed to lions and torn apart by horses and used for entertainment in the circus. Christians were being destroyed right and left, and yet Paul said, and we saw last week, he said, nevertheless, they that have that social power and authority that is granted to them are servants for God's sake. They may not know they're God's servants, but they are. God created social order, social structure, on purpose, and what we saw last week, to keep down the evil. Men, by their very nature, will run completely rampant and go crazy if there isn't some kind of social order telling them, no, don't do that, or we'll lock you in a box. If there weren't laws that said, if you kill, if you steal, if you'll, then we'll do these things to you, then men would run absolutely rampant. So God set up social order, government, on purpose. Israel, first thing he did was give Israel judges. That's why the book of Judges is in the Old Testament. Before they ever had a king, they had judges set up. Social order is inherent to the way God has set up people on planet Earth. What if they're evil? Well, when Paul was writing this, this was not a good government. So now you got two choices. Paul said, either you can go fight and they'll kill you, because they, after all, are the Roman government. They control fully one quarter of the landmass of the world. They are the Roman Empire. They will stomp and destroy you. Or you do what Jesus said, be in the world and not of the world. Live a quiet life. Do the right thing. Be in the society, salt and light. Treat people well. Be honest to every man. Be just. Be fair. And then he said, you don't have to be afraid, because you're doing the right thing. You don't have to be afraid that the police are going to show up at your door and haul you off if you're doing the right thing. Because, and you can have confidence in this, because God is in control. Everything Paul is saying here is predicated on God is in control. Because now he's about to say, where we stopped last week, now he's about to say, pay your taxes. And we all kind of, there is, even among the more radical Christian groups out there, you know, anti-tax groups, you know, no doubt, and I'm no big fan of taxes, but as long as the law says pay them, Paul says, well, follow the law. You're only here for a short time. You're pilgrims. You're passing through planet Earth. This is not your home. This is not where you're going to stay. You're on your way to your heavenly destiny. And while you're passing through this world, play the game the way they say the game is played. Don't be stupid enough to get yourself locked in a box for not paying your taxes. Instead, do the right thing, do the good thing, and then you're free to go out and promote positive things. Now, okay, that's the mind frame. That's the mindset that Paul's writing from. Chapter 13. Verse 1, let every person or every soul be subject to the higher powers. I told you that is the word exousia. It is not dunamis. It is not spiritual power. It is authority that is granted to somebody. It is an allowed or a permissible authority. So the people who have an office or who have some power on planet Earth in the government, they are allowed that power by God, who is all-powerful. He allows them the right to judge or the right to execute laws, but they don't have the power inherent in themselves. For there is no power but of God. There you are. And the powers that be are ordained of God. We covered all that last week. Whosoever therefore resisteth the exousia, this allowed power that God set up, resists the ordinance of God, because God's in control. This is the way he set it up. And they that resist shall receive to themselves, the King James says, damnation. It's not, it's krima, it just means judgment. You will receive some form of judgment. It does not mean damnation from God, but some form of judgment. Oh, and by the way, that word krima, or judgment, can mean judgment from the world. It doesn't have to mean a godly judgment either, but I mentioned that. Verse 3, rulers are not a terror to good works. Rulers are a terror to evil works. So will then you not be afraid of the power? Would you rather just not be afraid of the government? Well, then do that which is good, and you will have praise of the government. For he is, the King James says, minister. I've pointed out to you that that is the word diakonia. It means servant. For he, the guy who is the political power, is the servant of God to thee for good. But if you do that which is evil, then be afraid. Because he beareth not the sword in vain, because he is the servant of God. He is a revenger to execute judgment or wrath upon him that does evil. Wherefore ye must needs be subject not only because of the wrath, but also for your own conscience' sake. That's where we cut off last week. Starting at verse 6. For this cause pay ye tribute. Now the Romans were big into taxes. There were taxes for everything. In fact, at one point Jesus entered into Bethsaida, and just as he got into the city, they hit him with a tax. They hit him with a stranger tax. We don't know you. Pay us. Taxes everywhere. For this cause, for your conscience sake and for the lack of wrath, then go ahead and pay your taxes, your tribute also. For they are God's servants, and they attend continually upon this very thing. God has set the government up to take care of the society and protect you. Every time I pay taxes and I start to get upset about it, I think to myself, okay, a lot of bad things are happening with my taxes, but I really do like the roads. I enjoy the fact that there are roads I can drive on. And if there ever were a problem, somebody breaks in my house, I would like to be able to call the police who are paid for with my taxes. And I would like them to actually show up and be trained and have guns. And I'd like them to come in and protect me. That's Paul's thinking here. He's saying, if you're a good citizen doing the right thing, then they are no terror to you. And you should pay the tribute to them, because after all, they are God's servants, and they attend continually upon this very thing. So verse 7, render therefore to everyone their due. Whatever anyone is due, pay them. Tribute to whoever tribute is due, custom to whoever custom is due, fear to whom fear, and honor to whom honor. Tribute and custom, by the way, are two different forms of taxes. There were tribute given to Caesar because he was Caesar. It was practically a tithe. It was a form of worship to Caesar. And then there were taxes, local taxes, stranger taxes, city taxes, all that kind of thing. That was called custom. It was customary that you would pay it. Tribute was because he was who he was. Jesus, when he came into Bethsaida, and they came to him and asked him, doesn't your master pay taxes? And he said to Peter, you remember? Hey, go down to the stream, catch a fish, open the fish's mouth, there'll be a gold coin in it. Give the gold coin to the guy for our tax, and we'll go on our merry way. That was Jesus' attitude. It was like, yeah, pay it, pay it. And Jesus miraculously provided the money to pay it. Jesus paid tax. Now, they also tried to trick Jesus. And they came to Jesus. Here, look at Matthew. I think it's Matthew 22. Flip backwards to Matthew. Yeah, Matthew 22:15. Jesus said essentially the same thing Paul said here. Paul got his theology from Jesus. Matthew 22:15. Everybody there? Then went the Pharisees, and they took counsel on how they might entangle Jesus in his talk. So they sent out unto him their disciples with the Herodians. The Herodians were those who followed King Herod. And they said to him, Master, we know that thou art true, and you teach the way of God in truth. I got to ask you a question. Did they really know that? Did they really believe that? No, of course not. They're trying to trick him. So they start off by flattering him. They start out with a little bit of flattery. We know that you are true, and you teach the way of God in truth. Neither do you care for any man, or do you regard not the person of men. In other words, you don't care about men of high estate, low estate. You just tell the truth to everybody. You don't seem to have any real fear of the fact that we are the Herodians. We work for the king here. Hello. But we know that you're true. You don't care about any man. So let us ask you a question. Verse 17, tell us therefore, what do you think? Is it lawful to give tribute unto Caesar or not? Now, the reason I just said, the reason you gave tribute to Caesar was because he was Caesar, and it was a form of worship, because Caesar was God. Caesar was to be worshipped like a god. So now they try to trick Jesus with his words. They just said, we know that you teach the true way of God, God in heaven, in truth. So now what do you say? Should you pay tribute, which is a form of worship, to Caesar? Now, if he says no, they can arrest him instantly, because that's tax revolt. He has said, no, don't pay tribute to Caesar. If he says that, they've got him. If he says yes, then he's admitting that Caesar is a god, and they've just said, you teach the word of God, Yahweh, truly, oh, but Caesar's a god too. What happened to that whole one god thing? We got him now. So Jesus perceived their wickedness. These were not sincere guys trying to get to the bottom of a story. Jesus perceived their wickedness, and he said, "Why tempt ye me, ye hypocrites? Show me the tribute money." So they brought him a penny. And he said unto them, "Whose is this image and the superscription?" Now the penny, the coin, had a picture of Caesar on it, and it had Caesar's name on it. He said, "So whose is the picture and whose is the superscription?" And they said, "Well, that's Caesar's." And he said, "Okay then, render to Caesar the things that are Caesar, and unto God the things that are God's." It's a revolutionary statement. People read past that and miss what he just said. He said, that coin has Caesar's picture on it. It's already Caesar's. It belongs to Caesar. Just give it back to Caesar. But render to God, who is God, the things that are God's. In other words, Caesar's not God. See what he just did? He said, yeah, give Caesar his coinage. Big deal. They belong to Caesar. But there are higher, more important things that belong to God, and give those things to God because he's the only God. And when they heard these words, they marveled. He had them dead to rights. They came to tangle him up in his words. He tangled them back and knew that they were evil and just trying to trick him and hypocrites, and he sent them off. And they left him and they went their way. And you'll find them later getting together and plotting again to see if they can't get to him. So, back to Romans. Romans 13. So then, should you pay taxes? Well, Jesus' answer was, take a look at your money. Who does it belong to? Who printed the money? The government printed the money. Yeah. Whose image is on the money? Yours? No, the government's image is on it. Yeah. There's always presidents and Capitol buildings, and it may say "In God We Trust," but what they mean is they don't really mean it. Sure, they came to Jesus and didn't mean it.
I was going to say, yeah, that's
they are. They're taking it off. They're working to take it off. The new dollars they're printing. Right. They're working. Oh yeah. So who does the money belong to? It belongs to the government. They print it. If you don't pay it back to them when they say you owe it, you make some money and they say, okay, now you owe us 23% of that. In fact, they don't even give you the chance to pay it. You don't pay taxes, they take taxes. The government has the right. Now think about it for a moment. It's your job, you do the work, you show up, you're working. They have the right to take that money before it ever gets into your hands. So whose money is it really? And if they get together and vote to take more of your money, can they?
Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. So whose money is it? It is the world's money. It belongs to the world, and the world will insist on getting its money back. But God's in control. So you don't have to worry about it. You will always have enough money to take care of yourself. You'll have your food, you'll have your clothes. You'll be okay because God's in control. You belong to him and he loves you. He'll give you the things you need to get by in this life. So then, he says, I'm back in Romans 13, render therefore to all their dues, tribute to whom tribute is due, custom to whom custom, fear to whom fear, honor to whom honor. Some people deserve, by their station in life, some form of honor. If you go to court, which I did recently, the guy in the black robe, when he sits up there in his little judicial podium area, they all refer to him as
Your Honor.
Sure. Now, I don't know this guy. And once he takes the robe off and steps down, if I meet him on the street, I don't have to call him Your Honor. But if he puts the black robe on and he sits up there, he is the judge in that court, and he deserves, by virtue of the station, some form of honor. And so you will refer to him as judge or Your Honor. Judge so that you know that he's the one who has the right to judge this thing, and Your Honor because he's due that honor. You don't go up to the judge and say, "Yo, Bill," or "Yo, Dave." That's contempt. In fact, they've even created a law called contempt of court, where if you don't address the court the way the court wants to be addressed, they can get you for not liking them. Paul said, okay, now knowing that going in, since you know that these guys expect and by virtue of their station deserve a relative amount of honor, what are you going to do? Play it safe. Be smart. What good are you to the church at large? What good are you to the fellow people who are trusting you if you go in there, act stupid, and get yourself thrown in a box? You're no help at all. If I had gone to court a couple weeks ago, which I did, and got on the stand, which I did, raised my right hand and swore in, which I did, and then told the judge that I had contempt for him, have I helped any of you? Have I helped the church? Have I helped the body? No. The only way I can help this body is to be back here the next Sunday doing what I can do for them. So I went and played the court game. It's the world's game. And I sat through the court game and I did the court thing. And I called him Your Honor and I raised my right hand and I told the truth. And then I came home. Because this is what's important to me, not that. Understand all that? So when I pay my taxes because this is what's important to me, not that. Fear to whom fear? I don't like Bill Clinton. I'm not convinced that he's that moral a man or that he's really that good a president. I don't agree with most of his policies. But if the motorcade showed up in front of my house with the presidential limousine, with the presidential seal and the big presidential flags, and a couple of Secret Service men came in and opened the door and in walked Bill, I doubt that I would be a jerk to him. He's the president, for heaven's sake. The president of the United States of America. I am going to react accordingly. I'm going to treat him nicely. I'm going to treat him kind. I'm going to call him sir. I'm going to call him Mr. President. I'm going to follow what they want me to. Queen of England shows up, I'm likely to bow or curtsy or whatever it is they want me to do because she's got the position. It's her job. God, who is in control, gave them the job, and they are due a certain amount of respect and honor by virtue of the office. Understand? So then, verse 8, pay everything you ought to pay because, verse 8, don't owe any man anything. In other words, if you owe taxes, pay your taxes. If you owe a man some honor, give him the honor. Don't owe any man anything but this, but to love one another. For he that loveth another has fulfilled the entirety of the law. So, God, in the Old Testament, book of Exodus, gives us the Levitical law, the books of Leviticus, Deuteronomy, the entire Levitical law. Constant little details, do this, do that. Did you know that if you built a house and didn't put a easement off the side of the house so that if a man was working on your roof and he fell and rolled, he wouldn't hit the ground and died? Could you put the easement there? That's in the law. If you build a house and you didn't put an easement on it, broke the law of God. There's so many ways to break the law of God. You're walking down the street and your neighbor's cattle has fallen into a ditch, but you're in a big hurry. If you don't stop and help that cattle and return it to your neighbor, you've broken the law. If you pick up sticks on a Sabbath, that's worthy of stoning. There were so many ways to break the law. Paul said, it all boils down to this. Love one another. And if you in fact genuinely love one another, he said, you will have fulfilled the entirety of God's law. What God genuinely expects from you can be wrapped up in this, that you actually, sacrificially care about each other. Now look at this. Watch the logic. Verse 9. Because all this, thou shalt not commit adultery, thou shalt not kill, thou shalt not steal, thou shalt not bear false witness, thou shalt not covet. And if there be any other commandment, as you go read through the Levitical law and the Deuteronomical law, as you read through all those commandments, they are briefly comprehended in this saying. The saying being, thou shalt love thy neighbor as thyself, because love worketh no ill to his neighbor, and therefore love is the fulfilling of the law. That's why Christians aren't afraid of the Mosaic law anymore. There are Christians out there and theologies within Christendom that are trying to keep the law still. There are people still trying to impose the law of Moses on Christians. The reason we're not concerned about the law is because, number one, Christ nailed it to his cross, took it out of the way. We already saw that in Romans. Number two, Christ fulfilled the law on our behalf and gained a perfect righteousness that's imputed to us. And thirdly, our obligation before the law is to care for one another and take care of each other, and then all the little details of the law dissipate. Pop quiz. Thou shalt not commit adultery. Which commandment is that? There's 10 of them.
Seven.
Seven. Very good. Thou shalt not kill. Which one's that?
Six.
Thou shalt not steal. Which is that?
Ten.
Ten's covet. Give you a clue. See, just wondered if you knew.
Eight.
8, very good. And if there be any other commandment, it's comprehended in the saying, namely, thou shalt love thy neighbor as thyself. Because love works no ill to his neighbor, therefore love is the fulfilling of the law. Okay, now, look at Matthew 22. Go back there. Matthew 22 at like verse 35. You were just there a minute ago. Let me show you something else. Matthew 22, back where you were, verse 35. Paul got his theology that loving each other and caring for each other was the fulfillment of the law. He got that from Christ. Let's see, what did I say? Matthew 22, verse 35. Yeah, you were in the right area. The Sadducees and the Pharisees had just had a big fight. You know what the primary difference between the Sadducees and Pharisees is? Resurrection, exactly. Pharisees believed in a future resurrection, bodily resurrection. The Sadducees said that there was no resurrection. That was their point of contention between them. They were all Hebrew doctors and authorities and lawyers. They all believed in the law of Moses. The one key point that they differed on was whether or not there was a physical resurrection. So Jesus had just answered the Sadducees against their own theology. And that's why verse 34 says, now when the Pharisees had heard that Jesus had put the Sadducees to silence, they were gathered together. And they're going to get him. They're just so determined to get him somehow. Then one of them, which was a lawyer, in other words, studies the law of Moses, knows it well. One of them, which was a lawyer, asked Jesus a question, tempting him. In other words, you know, trying to trick him, going to trip him up. He said, Master, which is the greatest commandment in the law? Now, this guy is, after all, a lawyer. This guy studies the law of Moses. So he's now going to try to trick Jesus. And so he says, now, which is the greatest commandment? And Jesus, surprisingly, doesn't go to the Ten Commandments. This guy wanted one of the ten. You know, thou shalt not steal, thou shalt not kill, thou shalt not. He wanted one of those. Which is the greatest commandment? There's ten of them to choose from. Which one is it? And Jesus didn't go to the Ten Commandments. He said, thou shalt love the Lord thy God with all thy heart and all thy soul and with all thy mind, which is Deuteronomy 6:5. It's not in the Ten Commandments. This is the first and the great commandment. And the second one is like it. Thou shalt love thy neighbor as thyself. That's not one of the Ten Commandments. That's Deuteronomy 10:12. It's also in Leviticus 19:18, I think. So he says, here are the two great commandments. On these two commandments, look at verse 40, on these two commandments, love the Lord your God with all your heart, all your soul, and all your mind, and love your neighbor as yourself. On these two commandments hang all the law and all the prophets. He said, everything else you can find in the law and everything else you can find in the prophets all boil down to this one essential point. Love God, love your neighbor. If you genuinely, sacrificially love your neighbor as yourself, you're not going to have to worry about stealing from him. Or
those two are a summary of the Ten Commandments.
They are a perfect summary, not just of the Ten, of the whole Levitical law. The things like building an easement off your roof. Well, if you loved your neighbor enough to not want him to get hurt, you would build the easement because you cared about him. The difference was that the Israelites came to see all of that as a standard of perfection that had to do with the external doing. Just do it, do it, do it, do it, do it, and God would see that you were doing it. And because you were doing it in an external fashion, he would approve of you and give you blessings for having done it. But Jesus internalized it and said in his Sermon on the Mount, he said, you've heard it said, thou shalt not kill. And so everybody in the room who had not killed could say, yes, I've kept the law, I did not kill. And Jesus went past it to the attitude of the heart and said, what I say to you, you've heard Moses say to you, don't kill, but I say to you, taking to himself superior authority over Moses, and said, yeah, the law says don't kill, but I say, if you hate your brother in your heart, you're guilty as a murderer. Oh, well, see, now everybody in the room's guilty. They could all go, well, I've never killed, I'm okay. He went past it into the attitude of the heart and said, yeah, but if you've hated in your heart, you're guilty anyway. You've heard it said in the law of Moses, thou shalt not commit adultery. Everybody in the room could go, well, I have no, okay, I feel good about, okay. And he says, but if you lusted in your heart, you're guilty as an adulterer. Well, then everybody's guilty again. So Jesus went past the law. When he talked to the Pharisees, who were bragging about how good they kept the law and how they gave tithes of their mint and their cumin and their spices and all the good things they did, Jesus came to him and said, well, it's fine that you did all that, and you should have, but you have neglected the weightier matters of the law. Mercy, judgment, righteousness. So Jesus and Paul have said, you want to keep the law? You want the law to not be a problem to you? Don't worry about the external actions. The external actions will take care of themselves if they start from a good heart. If they start from a person who loves God and loves his neighbor, the external actions, the good fruit, will naturally grow. Gosh, we're back to the beginning. Good actions will come from people who are trying to do the godly, right, loving, sacrificial thing. And you won't need somebody to give you a list of what to do and not to do. You will naturally do the good and the right thing, and you'll know what the wrong thing is because you have the right attitude. You cannot kill and have the wrong attitude and be guilty. But you can have the right attitude and then see that as the fulfilling of the entire law. So the law isn't a problem to you anymore. The Mosaic law, the Ten Commandments, all that stuff at Sinai, all the do this, don't do that, do this, don't do that, do this, don't do that. For the Christian, that's done away with. That's not the standard anymore. The standard is love God with all your heart, your soul, and your mind, and love your neighbor as yourself. And all of the law and the prophets aren't a problem for you. You will naturally do the right and the just thing because you've got the Spirit of God living inside you, driving you toward the right thing. Now, will you always do the right thing? You going to mess up? Yeah, probably. But do you see how complete the Christian salvation is? That's the cool part about genuine Christian salvation, is that it is a salvation, as Paul said, of body, soul, and spirit. That he changes you from the inside, changes your attitude, changes your heart, but then also redeems those things that you've done wrong. So there's a complete salvation. You got nothing to answer for. You get to heaven and you say, and before you get a chance to defend yourself, Christ becomes your attorney. Christ stands up in your defense and says, I paid for that. We don't have to talk about him. So yeah, it's a good deal. Because I've done plenty of things I don't want to talk about. The bad part of that is I want credit because my flesh is my flesh. My flesh wants credit for the good things I've done. I'd like him to forget the bad stuff, but remember the good stuff. Remember that good thing I did? You don't get that either. You get Christ's righteousness imputed to you because it's a genuine and a perfect righteousness. So you get no credit. Instead, you're the recipient of grace. You don't get judged for what you've done wrong. Instead, it's all about Christ. And we all get to praise and glorify him eternally for the incredible grace of being there in his presence. Not because of you, but because of him. All right, I never did make it to the last four verses of chapter 13. So that's where we'll pick up next week. But we need to spend a little time on it anyway. So. Are you getting a sense of Paul's attitude, how you should live, the Christian perspective for life? Your primary obligation is to the body of Christ, the church, but your obligations as a citizen are to do the good and the right thing. Your obligation to the world is to treat them fairly, give them a cup of water, feed them if they're hungry, do the right thing by them, and it is not yours to judge because God will righteously judge. Judgment is mine. Vengeance is mine, saith the Lord. I will recompense. Your job is to be salt and light, be available, give an answer to every man who asks, and recognize that you can't get good fruit out of bad trees. So instead, bless them, speak well of them, walk away. There's the Christian perspective in a nutshell. I could have saved you hours and just said that.